Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest today is Christina Koning, talking about her novel End of Term. We'll also hear from children's author Anne-Marie Howell, talking about her new novel, The House of 100 Clocks, and former president of Lucy Cavendish College, Cambridge, that's Jackie Ashley. She'll be chatting about the recently announced longlist for the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize. But Christina, first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's lovely to have you. And we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. I said books and writing with a local slant there. And it is very local, this show, because Anne-Marie Howell's book is set in Cambridge. Lucy Cavendish College, obviously one of the colleges of Cambridge University. And your novel, End of Term, Christina, as we'll hear, set in Cambridge. But you're not from Cambridge originally, are you?
I wasn't born here, but I was an undergraduate here many years ago. And I came back here when my children were born. They were both born in Addenbrookes Hospital and then moved away again. And this is my third time living in Cambridge. I came back, actually, I was a Royal Literary Fund Fellow at Newnham, Selwyn and Lucy Cavendish, by coincidence, for 2 years. So I have a lot of connections with Cambridge, even though I wasn't brought up and born here. I feel it's my real home, if that makes sense.
And you set a lot of your writing here. It's quite an inspiring place as a location for writing.
Very much so. I mean, when I moved back here and I first started writing crime fiction, which was a bit of a departure for me from my previous fiction, which was literary and historical novels, Richard Reynolds at Heffer's Bookshop, who has been a great supporter and was very kind and took on some of my crime books, said to me in one of our conversations, "So when's your next book going to be set? And where?" Cambridge, I think, is a good idea. And I thought, yes, I went away and started writing End of Term. And Cambridge, as you say, it's an inspiring place, but also because of the structure of this particular book, which as it's a detective story, has a setting of Cambridge colleges. That was such a gift to be able to describe them and, in fact, describe my own college from the past. And so, yes, it was a delight to write about.
You mentioned Richard Reynolds there from Heffer's Bookshop, who often gets mentioned by crime writers. He really should be the patron saint, I think, of crime writers. And lots of crime writers, actually, in Cambridge.
Well, I've met quite a few at Heffer's events, the Murder Under the Mistletoe event and the What's Your Poison event, which I've been very lucky to be asked to speak on several occasions with other crime writers, many of whom, as you say, are Cambridge-based. So, yes, it's quite a community here.
Lovely. Well, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, as I say, but we'll listen to your first choice of music in just a moment. Is music important to you, Christina?
Very much. My children are musicians, in actual fact, and play in a band and have done for a number of years. But it has always been a love, and it's always something that I feel as a strong link with my writing, because I tend to derive a certain amount of atmosphere and inspiration from particular music of a period. Since I write a lot of work with a historical setting, it's just a way of immediately getting an insight into the past if you hear the music, and particularly the popular music of the time. So yes, I would say it's very important.
And this one, The Night We Called It a Day by Frank Sinatra, why this one?
My second novel, Undiscovered Country, was set in Venezuela in the 1950s. Father went there before the Second World War, my mother afterwards. They met there and I grew up there as a young child. So I have sort of strong connections with the place. And so writing about that expatriate community of the Maracaibo oil fields, Sinatra was such a figure of the period. I mean, really for several periods, but certainly for the 50s is when I think some of his greatest performances and recordings date from then. So this song, I used it as a backdrop for a particular cocktail party my characters were sort of all gathering. And so it just seemed to me to convey the atmosphere of the time so beautifully.
There was a moon out in space, but a cloud drifted over its face.
That was The Night We Called It A Day by Frank Sinatra, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Christina Conan. Christina's worked as a travel writer and journalist. A Mild Suicide came out in 1992 and was shortlisted for the David Higham Prize for Fiction. Undiscovered Country was published in 1997, won the Encore Prize and was longlisted for the Orange Prize. Her first crime novel, Line of Sight, was published in 2014, in which she introduced her hero, Frederick Rowlands, a blind veteran of World War I. Heat described it as compulsively readable. Game of Chance came out a year later. Literary Review called it an excellent read. And the Rowlands books have continued up to her most recent End of Term, set in the fictional St. Gertrude's College in Cambridge during the end of term festivities of 1935. So, Christina, 1935, as I said, and we will be talking, obviously, a lot about end of term, but looking back on your previous work, most, if not all of it, is set in the past, is historical. Why is that?
I'm interested in the past, I suppose, is a very simple answer. But I think that almost all writing does deal with some aspect of the past. Even contemporary fiction has to deal with memory to some extent, or things that have happened to the characters or to the writer. Just in the nature of the way our minds work and our brains work, I suppose there has to be reflection on things that have happened before. My interest is very much to do with, I suppose, my own history, but also mainly with the history of recent times, the sort of backdrop of the Second World War and the Great Depression, and some of the things that have sort of shadowed the lives of my parents and grandparents. I have actually written about the more distant past with some of my other novels, but for the most part, I think they have all been 20th century history, which brings me back to my own sort of life and my own family.
What about crime fiction? Because the earlier works, say historical fiction, literary fiction, how did it end up with you writing crime fiction?
I was originally going to write about my grandfather, Charles Thompson, who, as you said in your introduction, was a veteran of the First World War. He was a gunner and he fought at Passchendaele, which is where he lost his sight to an explosion, I think, to shrapnel. I was interested in him as a character, and as it came up to the anniversary of the beginning of the First World War, in 2014, and I knew that I wanted to write something about Charles. It was only halfway through writing the book that I realised it would be a detective story, and that's partly because of the character's job, which is that he was trained as a telephonist. It was one of the jobs that blind people could do, and that's what my grandfather did, actually. And he worked in a solicitor's office in the city. In those days, solicitors dealt with criminal cases as well as, conveyancing and that sort of thing. And so he actually was involved in some quite interesting cases. I mean, he wasn't a lawyer, but he was, he worked in the office. Oddly enough, one of his co-workers was Amy Johnson, the famous woman flyer. I've written about her in another of the Rowlands books, Time of Flight, which is about aviation and the craze for flying. So I started to think this would be an interesting basis for a detective story. And the fact that my detective is blind actually just makes him pay more attention to other things through hearing, through smell, through atmosphere. And he has to use his wits. And actually, for a reader, it's not such a disadvantage because, after all, most visual passages in novels are described either by someone who's sort of telling you about them or through memory. And of course, he can rely, my character Fred, can rely on his memory of the visual world. Yeah, it was an interesting challenge, let's say.
Yes, I didn't know when I was reading it whether you'd made it easier for yourself or harder for yourself by having him as a blind man. Easier in that, as you say, you didn't have to do lengthy pieces of description, which some writers don't like doing, but harder in the sense that you had to therefore concentrate on everything else and all those other senses.
You can't let yourself get away with things. It has to be seen from Fred's point of view. He can't see people's expression, for example. He can hear expression in their voices, and he can interpret some of the things that are said in a way that I think one does actually in conversation. You pick up signals, which are not visual clues, but which are there. It's just different, actually, from writing with the full set of senses. And actually, as Fred himself has said, and as other works I read when I was researching this in the beginning made clear, it's just a question of using your other senses a bit more intensely. That seemed to me to be the clue, and the way of doing it was to just describe things in a different way. There was quite a lot of clues given to me in a book, for example, called My Story of St. Dunstan's, which was the Institute for Blinded Servicemen. The head of it, Sir Ian Fraser, wrote a wonderful book about his own blindness. He was also a young soldier. And he said, well, when you walk into a room, you can hear a fire crackling and you can smell it. You can tell if it's raining from the sound of raindrops on the window pane. You can tell the size of a room because there's sometimes an echo. I just thought these were amazing things, you know, that I was able to use quite a lot of the detail that he gave me in his wonderful book.
And St. Dunstan's features, of course, doesn't it? Because it's where Rowlands works. And it's also 1935, so it's when good old-fashioned police work existed, isn't it? There's no mobile phone records or anything like that. It's shoe leather, walking and asking questions and listening out for clues.
Yes, very much so. And Rowlands is fortunate in having not only a friend, Chief Inspector Alistair Douglas, who's in the force, but also a very sensible wife, Edith. She's his sort of visual assistant, as it were, and can obviously describe things from that point of view. Because it would be hard for the reader if there were no visual description. I mean, there is some visual description, as you've probably gathered. You know, I think that would be asking a lot of the reader to have none at all.
And 1935, an interesting time, because it's one of those interwar years, although it's looking very much like war will happen. And in terms of colleges at Cambridge, where this novel is set, women allowed to study but not allowed to be awarded degrees.
That interested me very much. I was aware that women weren't granted equal degrees until 1948, and that also applied to the staff. All the fellows of the college were not allowed to call themselves doctor or professor. They were just miss, or in some cases misses, but mainly miss, unless they had graduated from Oxford, which actually awarded women degrees in 1920. So it seemed to me that was quite a telling moment, that those few years, that women had to fight very hard to be taken seriously. And of course, there were those in the university establishment who disapproved of women being educated at all, and certainly didn't really approve of women having equal status as dons. So, you know, there was a lot to grapple with, and I felt it was an interesting time. And of course, I felt quite indignant about it. I felt it needed to be flagged up, that this hadn't always been something we could take for granted.
And I like it that these women, a lot of them are studying sciences as well. It would have been easy to give them the more humanities-based subject, but they're actually studying, quantum physics.
Well, again, because Cambridge was the cutting edge, as you know, in those days, and a lot of the research that was being done at the Cavendish Institute in Free School Lane led, you know, directly to some of the innovations that were, you know, later became so significant during the war. I mean, obviously the development of radar and the splitting of the atom, and, you know, and all that led to. So it was extremely high tech, and they were really far ahead of other institutions. And I have to say that as a non-scientist, I mean, I studied English, so I seem to like to make things difficult for myself, but I found it fascinating the more I found out about that world and how difficult it was for women as well. They were very few in the intake in science. It was even more exclusionary, you know, for women in science and mathematics than it was for people going into the humanities, as you said. So it made sense to make my characters scientists. They were really sort of setting a trend, or blazing a trail, maybe.
Thank you, Christina. We'll come back to you in just a moment. Let's stay actually in the subject of Cambridge colleges, and Lucy Cavendish College in particular. We're talking now to Jackie Ashley. Jackie worked for over 30 years as a political journalist. She's now a specialist advisor to the House of Lords Economic Affairs Committee, a judge for the Royal Television Society's News and Current Affairs Awards, and is an honorary fellow of Lucy Cavendish College, Cambridge, having formerly been president. She's on the judging panel of the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize, the long list for which was announced last month. When I spoke to Jackie, we started by reflecting on the success of the award, which has produced some notable winners.
Yes, well, it's the 10th year now for the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize, and it has really gone from strength to strength. And over the years, we've had some fantastic successes. We've had First Book Award, Costa First Book Awards, we've had bestsellers, we've had people selling TV and film rights. It's really gone from a small, fairly unknown prize to something that's now a really major event in the fiction calendar, which is a fantastic achievement by the whole team who've been running it over the years.
And you get thousands of entries now, don't you?
Well, not thousands. We average between 400 and 500. This year is our second biggest ever entry, 400 plus. We've actually had to make a decision not to allow international entries because we were having so many people wanting to enter the prize. And the time for our poor judges is limited as it is. There's an awful lot to read through. And it was just becoming unmanageable because we like to have the same judges read every single book that comes in. And there's a limit to how many you can do unless it becomes a full-time job. So we very sadly had to say no international entries, only from the UK and Ireland. But I think we could go even bigger if we had the capacity.
So that is a lot of reading. When you sit down to look at a manuscript, what are you looking for?
I think the main thing is unput down ability. And I think that's a very hard thing to define, what is unput down ability. But you almost know from the first five pages if you're going to love this or not. I should say, by the way, that we don't take complete novels. We take the first 50 pages and a synopsis of the rest. So it's obviously not quite such a major read as it would be otherwise. But within 5 or 10 pages, you can usually tell if this is going to grab you or not. And the advice we give to budding writers is we all know when we read, there's those times when you think, oh, I'm just going to skip over that because it's a bit dull. And you turn the page and I skip over that bit. So you reread your novel and you think, if that's a bit that I would probably skip over if I was a reader, then cut it. Writers don't like to cut stuff because they think I've spent hours crafting these words. But we tend to find the best novelists are the ones that have cut and cut again and gone through it ruthlessly and said, is this really grabbing the reader?
And you've announced the long list this week. What does it take to move from the long list into the short list?
Well, this is the really crucial time. Many on the long list do go on to get representation and to get published, and that's fantastic. So even being on the long list, which is 22 this year, is a fantastic achievement. And they've done terribly well to beat the field of 430, I think it was, this year. But to get to the short list, which is always 6 or 7, that really is a guarantee of success. So if you get down to the last 6 or 7, you are virtually guaranteed a representation with an agent. You will then have all the powers of a big agent coming to help you refine the novel. And often quite big changes are made, but you know, the novel is refined as an agent will do. And then you're very likely to get published and to go from strength to strength. And interestingly, I think our two biggest successes, one in particular was Gail Hunnemann's Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine, which I'm sure you will know of.
Oh,
which
that's a brilliant
international
novel. Yes.
Bestseller. Interestingly, she did not win the prize in the year in which she entered. She was shortlisted. So it just goes to show that you don't have to actually be the winner, but just to be shortlisted is enough. Our other great success, and my favourite of all time, is Sarah Collins, The Confessions of Franny Langton, which was 2 years ago. Now,
she's won
all sorts of awards. And again, she wasn't actually the winner. She was shortlisted. So getting to that 6 or 7 is really, really crucial. And any one of those 6 or 7 could become the next international bestseller.
And what is it that the 6 or 7 on the shortlist have that takes them above the rest of the long list?
They've all got something that makes them stand out as being different, I think. In particular, the two I've mentioned, Franny Langton and Ellen Oliphant, they're very unusual voices. They're voices that you haven't heard before, and they're carried through with great integrity. So you don't for a minute think, oh, this is someone writing about this person. You think, this is this person. So they're very authentic voices, and they manage to carry it right through the novel. I think that's probably the most important thing. Quite often we find novels and you think, oh, this is one in that genre, yes, and it's very, very good, but it doesn't stand out. But I think the individuality of these real successes is what's important.
And famously, of course, the award is open only to women. Some mm-hmm. critics might say, in this day and age, do we still really need an award that's just for women?
Well, we constantly face this criticism, and indeed Lucy Cavendish, the college where it started and in whose name it is actually going mixed from next autumn. So there's been another chorus of, well, we must open up the prize to men only. I think we still feel that there's a fairly unequal playing field when it comes to men and women in fiction. The men do tend to dominate all the big prizes. But we don't believe it hurts anybody for us to have the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize for Women. And for now, it's a great success. It has discovered a number of female novelists that may not have been discovered without it. And so for now, we're determined to carry it on. And the other thing that's very interesting about it, it is, and perhaps it is a female thing, all the shortlisted authors, and indeed the longlist, they tend to get to know each other and they become firm friends. And years on now, there's gatherings of shortlistees together. They all keep together on Twitter and they have actual meetups, well, actual meetups when they're allowed. And there is a great sense of a family, the family of the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize, which I don't think you'd get with any other prize. And I wonder if you'd get if men were in it as well.
And this is your third year as a judge. Do you find that there are particular themes that emerge each year, that one year women are writing about one thing or seem to be mainly writing about one thing, and the next year there's a preponderance of stories about another thing?
Yes, that does tend to happen a little bit. So when Eleanor Oliphant first came through, that was in 2014 when she was on the shortlist. And then we did have quite a few sort of following that genre of slightly sort of, you know, interesting people whose voices aren't normally heard. Probably next year, I'm sure we'll have quite a lot about sort of lockdown and viruses. And indeed, this lockdown probably has prompted many, many people to try their hands at those first 50 pages of the synopsis. So we're expecting a bumpy year next year.
And of course, this year might be different, but when would you normally meet as a judging panel? Do you actually usually meet face to face?
Oh, yes, indeed. And very sadly, this year has obviously been very disrupted. The long list was already delayed, but it has just come out. The shortlist we were due to do, well, that should be coming out about now, but it's been delayed. And then the final panel, which is where we have the six or seven, where we all meet for quite a long time, usually in the sunny garden of Lucy Cavendish. I wish I could be there now. That should have been in June, but that's now been delayed till September. And fingers firmly crossed, we're going to be able to meet in the garden of Lucy Cavendish in September, but we're well aware we might be Zooming by September. We just don't know. So everything has been delayed, but we'll get there in the end, and hopefully next year we'll be back to normal.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall at those meetings, because I guess people sometimes go in with a particular favourite that they're arguing for.
You'll be surprised to hear those meetings go on quite a long time. There's seven or eight of us usually at those final meetings, and we nearly always have one that we think is the one. And then there's quite a battle goes on. I think we've even had years where we thought, well, can we have two? But we thought, no, we must put it down to one. And so we usually end up with a majority. But yes, we're all very different people. We all have very different backgrounds. We all have very different styles of novels that we like. So it is difficult. And as I say, it's quite comical, really, that quite often the one that becomes a big success is not the one we've all picked. So I think we're all quite sort of easygoing about, well, if one wins, that's fine. If it wasn't my particular choice, maybe my particular choice will trump it in the end. So that's fine. But they're very passionate meetings. Everyone feels very strongly about them. We all read them very carefully. We often read them twice or three times over to make sure we really are fair. And then we are, to an extent, influenced by each other's views as well. We all bring different bits of history to the judging process. We have some novelists, we have some agents, we have a ghostwriter, we have myself, who's a journalist more than a fiction writer. We have all sorts of different people on the panel, and I think that's quite good. So, you know, if it was all just other authors, that would be one thing. If it was all just critics, that would be another thing. But we always try to have a mix on the panel.
And we talked about what makes a good read. Are there common failings, if you like, mistakes, errors that you see in manuscripts that rule them out straight away?
One thing is excessive use of exclamation marks. Another thing is, I think quite often people would try and write in a dialect and then not carry it through very well. I think it's important not to do that too much unless you really know what you're doing. Some try to be a bit too clever. They have sort of plots that by the time you're on sort of page 20, you've already had to turn back 15 times to work out who was what and what plot was what. So sometimes keeping it fairly simple is the best answer, really. We do actually at the college run a creative writing course, which has been very successful. And we have actually found we've got some entries from people who've been on the course. It's all anonymous, of course, so we don't know they've been on the course. And I think that's very useful at giving people tips. We have Fiction Prize winners taking the course and giving talks about what they do. I think that's been really helpful for people to learn the skills of writing a novel, because everyone thinks they can write a novel, but actually it's a little bit more complicated than that.
And what about you? What's your favourite kind of novel? What do you like to read?
Well, I'm quite enjoying contemporary fiction these days. I have to say, I loved Ellen Oliphant and Sarah Collins' Franny Langton. So, I mean, very different books, but again, very unusual. The kind of book that you wouldn't have found, I would say, 10 years ago. You wouldn't have found those kind of books. Very much our contemporary society and history. So the two together, I think, is what I tend to like. I don't really like crime novels very much.
For more information about the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize and to see that long list, go to lucy.cam.ac.uk. And listening to that with me as our featured guest on Bookmark today, Christina Conan, here to talk about her novel, End of Term. Christina, Jackie's saying there, the best novelists are the ones who cut and cut again, edit like crazy. Is that something that you identify with?
Yes, very much. I've taught creative writing for a number of years, including at Cambridge. And I think that is a key thing that, you know, one says to students, that a lot of writing is editing. And actually, whilst it's important to have the initial inspiration, get the words down, you get the ideas across, one shouldn't be afraid of taking some of it away. It makes for better writing generally.
It's set, your novel, in a fictional Cambridge college, St Gertrude's, which has more than a passing resemblance to Girton College. I guess the university colleges, particularly Girton actually, because it's on the edge of town, and these big old buildings with these beautiful grounds, they offer great opportunities for plotting.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, when I first arrived at Girton's hallowed halls as a very shy and awkward 18-year-old, I was absolutely stunned by the kind of Victorian Gothic look of it. I mean, I describe it not altogether in a complimentary way in my novel as having blood red brick. It is very striking, as anyone who knows Girton, of course I love it now. But at the time, you know, all those turrets and twisty staircases and long corridors, it was a bit overwhelming. And of course, when it came to write a murder story, I mean, it's a perfect setting. It couldn't be better. It's just got a sort of mystery to it and a feeling of the past. You almost see ghosts whisking out of sight around the end of a corridor when you go there. And so yes, it was absolutely perfect setting.
And a murder also undercuts that air of respectability.
Yes, because of course what you see at the beginning is a very decorous garden party and all the undergraduates and their parents and the teaching staff at the end of a busy term. And of course the murder, as you say, does cut into that, and is a brutal reminder that there's a world outside that. The novel that precedes End of Term, Out of Shot, is set in Berlin in 1933, just after the rise of Hitler. I have made it clear throughout all these books that the political and historical background, which is quite menacing actually throughout the 30s, is always there, and the characters are going to get caught up in it whether they like it or not. Definitely not just hallowed halls.
And I think your next choice of music actually feeds into the 30s, am I right? Billie Holiday, You Go to My Head.
Yes, it does indeed. And I think a very beautiful rendition of this classic song. I've always loved Billie Holiday. And I think, yes, just such a beautiful, melancholy voice and such a beautiful song.
You go to my head and you linger like a haunting refrain. And I find you spinning round in my brain.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our featured guest on Bookmark today is Christina Koning, here to talk about her novel End of Term. And Christina, you're going to read an extract from it now.
Yes, I am. And this is a passage that occurs on the night of a college dance for students at St Gertrude's. It's ostensibly a happy and glamorous and delightful occasion. But as with everything in a murder mystery, there's a sort of undertone of something less pleasant and something rather more sinister. Fred Rowlands, he's just gone out to have a cigarette in the grounds after dinner while the dance is going on elsewhere so he can hear the music, and he's wandering about the rose garden just at this moment. Then, without warning, someone rushed out from beneath the arbour in front of which he had stopped and ran full tilt into him. Rowlands had a fleeting impression of a warm young body in a satin dress, a scent of hair and skin. "At last," cried a voice, "I'd almost given you up." "Oh," evidently having realised her mistake, "what are you doing here?" No vengeful goddess could have sounded more indignant. Rowlands held up his cigarette, although in truth he didn't owe her any kind of explanation. "Miss Havelock, I'm afraid you weren't looking where you were going." She mastered her temper with an effort, although she was still breathing hard. "I thought you were someone else," she said. She was trembling, he realised. "It's so beastly dark out here. I say, I couldn't have a cigarette, could I? He offered the pack to her and she took one, then held it to the flame of his lighter. Thanks. She took a deep drag and exhaled, seeming calmer now. Although something had happened to upset her a good deal, thought Rowlands. It didn't take much imagination to guess what that might be. She'd obviously been expecting someone, and that someone hadn't turned up. This impression was confirmed when she said abruptly, "What time is it, do you know?" He checked his watch. "Just on a quarter to." "Damn," the girl muttered under her breath. "Well, that's that, I suppose." She didn't offer any further explanation, nor did he expect one. For a few moments, the two of them stood in silence, smoking the cigarettes. Then she said, "Can I ask you something?" "Ask away." "What I want to know is, how does one know one can trust anybody?" It was said in a tone of extraordinary bitterness. And it wasn't a question which really required an answer, he thought, flung out as it had been in the heat of the moment, to one for whose opinion the speaker cared not a jot. Realising this, he still took a moment to consider his reply. "Well, one doesn't," he said. "One just has to follow one's instinct. And of course there are people one can trust," he added, thinking that he needed to offer some firmer assurance. "People who care about one, who have one's welfare at heart." His answer seemed to disappoint her, for she gave a short, unamused laugh. "It appears," she said, "that there aren't too many of those." "Don't you have a friend you can talk to?" he said, feeling somewhat out of his depth. If it was a disappointment in love to which her question had alluded, then he wasn't the ideal confidant. "I don't have many friends here." Again, that note of bitterness. "And those I thought I had..." She broke off as if she said more than she meant to. "Oh, what does it matter?" she muttered as if to herself. "It's all a rotten mess. I wish I'd never got into it in the first place." That did sound rather more serious than just a lover's tiff. A rotten mess. Rowlands wondered anew who it was she'd been intending to meet in the rose garden. Whoever it was, he'd clearly let her down. They had been walking back slowly in the direction of the college and had by now reached the path which led around the side of the building. Diana Havelock dropped her half-smoked cigarette on the gravel and ground it beneath her heel. "Better go," she said in a bright voice, quite at odds with her previous melancholy tone. "I'll need to powder my nose before I'm fit to be seen. Thanks for the cigarette." Rowlands raised a hand in valediction. He had been going to wish her an enjoyable evening, but then thought better of it. From what he had gathered, it didn't sound very likely she'd be enjoying herself much tonight, poor girl.
Thank you, Christina. You kind of touch on it a little bit in that extract. You say he's out of his depths. Roland's out of his depths in the sense he's in a female college. There's a class differential as well, isn't there? In that in 1935, the kind of women and the kind of people generally who went to Cambridge colleges were of a certain class and background.
I think that's true, although I think Girton has always been much more liberal, in actual fact, in its intake. And it did have people who weren't necessarily from the moneyed classes. The young women had to apply for scholarships, some of them, and they didn't have much money, or where, you know, they came from a home where, you know, they had brothers who had gone to Oxford or Cambridge or one of the other universities, and there wasn't the money to send them. But I feel that Cambridge, but particularly a college like Girton, was much more egalitarian. And in fact, that still carries on. It really matters to give people a chance who perhaps, you know, wouldn't otherwise have had it. In those days, it was women, but now, of course, it's co-ed.
And this isn't the first novel you've written about academia, is it? A Mild Suicide was also set in the world of academia. So clearly you're fascinated by that area.
I am, because I suppose I had a phase of being an academic myself. When I was in Edinburgh, which is where Mild Suicide is set, I was actually working towards a PhD in English. I like writing about place. I feel that place is as important as character. And so it was a good opportunity to revisit both an aspect of my past when I was a young graduate student. It's also set in a strange period, which is the sort of punk era, the novel set in 1977. So again, I like to contrast academic niceties with a much tougher reality, the world of slightly sort of strident music and a sort of street culture that has nothing whatsoever to do with, you know, sherry parties in Don's offices and things. So that was one of the things behind that. It's always interesting to revisit aspects of your own past and think, if this character, loosely based on me, though it isn't, what would she have done or how would she have felt at the time?
Thank you, Christina. Well, let's cast our mind back to perhaps, certainly for me, a long way back in the past now, to childhood now, when we speak to children's author A.M. Howe. The first novel for children by A.M. Howell came out last year called The Garden of Lost Secrets. The Times made it their children's book of the week and the Daily Mail called it an impressive debut. The House of 100 Clocks came out earlier this year. The Telegraph described it as hypnotically readable. I met Anne-Marie in Saffron Walden as she was visiting a school to talk to the pupils there about her work, and I asked her to tell me what the novel is about.
The House 100 Clocks is an Edwardian historical mystery set in Cambridge in 1905, and it's about a 12-year-old girl called Helena who goes with her clockwinder father to stay in the house of Mr. Westcott, who owns lots and lots of clocks. But when she arrives, Mr. Westcott says, "You must keep the clocks ticking at all costs, otherwise you will lose everything that you own." And the family have something very, very precious that is very important to them that they must not lose, and that's their lovely parrot called Orbit, which is a reminder of Helena's mother, who has sadly passed away. So Helena has lots of secrets to uncover in the house, including strange notes that appear on the walls and ghostly figures in the clock rooms and missing winding keys. So she has lots to sort out before time runs out.
So it's an element of lots of things, like ghost story, mystery.
It's not really a ghost story. I think that's a little bit misleading. So she sees a ghostly figure in the clock rooms thinking there's nobody else in the house, but it turns out there's another girl living in the house. So there's a little bit of a clue there. So she has to solve who this girl is and sort out what her problems are and help her solve her own mysteries.
And it's set in Edwardian times. Why that period?
I think it's a really underrated period in terms of fiction, actually. I think it's that period between 1901 and 1910, after the death of Queen Victoria. And not many people know much about that period, but the more I researched it, the more I found out it was a time of great invention and social change. So there were lots of inventions coming forward, like the vacuum cleaner, for example, that features in the book, that had to be brought up from London on a horse and cart. It was so enormous. And people would gather on the street to watch these huge hoses being put into rooms to suck out the dust. And also the Wright brothers flying machines were another invention that was just coming forward. But also Cambridge at that particular time was a really interesting place to be. Women were fighting for their rights much more and were studying at the university but couldn't actually graduate until 1947. So it was a real issue for women in terms of those that wanted to pursue an education, and that's something that features very largely in the book.
And your first novel was set in Ickworth House in Suffolk, second one, as you say, in Cambridge. This area of the country is good for storytelling.
It is. I think I've got enough stories to keep me going for a lifetime, actually, in this part of the country. And I think Cambridge is very special and close to my heart because it's a city I moved to after graduating from university and lived and worked there for a number of years. I used to cycle to work through the city, so got to know it really, really well. And I only live across the border in Suffolk now, so I still feel like Cambridge is really my home. And I thought it'd be a great setting for a story.
And what kind of age group are you aiming this for? What kind of readership is that?
So the age group is age 9 to 12, but actually I've had a lot of adults tell me that they really enjoy the book. So I've had quite some fan mail from adults as well as children, which is amazing. So I think anybody that loves historical fiction and a good mystery, I would really enjoy the book.
And when you're writing for that age group, 9 to 12, what are the particular things that you have to think about?
The thing with writing for children is you cannot rest on your laurels. You've got to keep them interested the whole way through the book and keep them hanging on and wanting to read the next chapter. So when I'm writing, I always try to think how I'm going to end a chapter and hook them into reading the next one, and hopefully keep them reading late into the night, way past their bedtime, under the covers, as I used to read when I was young. And also it's about including those really interesting little details from in historical fiction that will grab their interest. Not overloading it with detail, but just putting in those interesting things like the vacuum cleaner and little facts about the Wright brothers and cars that maybe it wouldn't have occurred to them, and will get them interested in that era in history.
And in terms of complexity of plot, how complex can the plot be?
I think kids' plots can be very complicated. In fact, sometimes more complicated than adults' books, interestingly enough. I think you have to plot a book quite carefully when you're writing for children and throw in lots of red herrings as well, as you would in adult fiction, and get them really guessing and trying to work out the mystery. And the feedback I've had so far is that quite a few people didn't guess the mystery in this book, which makes me very happy.
And this is your second novel. What did you learn from writing the first one? Did your writing change, for example?
I think it did. I think I see every new book as a new project and a chance to write something a little bit better than the first. I think you're always changing and progressing as a writer, and I work with some brilliant editors at Osborne who've really helped me develop, I think, and particularly look at how I can weave in those historical details without making the story too heavy and edit it really well as well.
And you're at Dame Bradbury School today here in Saffron Walden. What will you be doing today?
So today I'm going to be giving an author presentation to the school, which is fantastic. I'm so happy to be invited here. It's going to be about the House of 100 clocks and my research. I'm also going to be doing a really fun activity called Guess the Most Expensive Clock that's been going down very well with the schools I've visited so far.
And what do you get from these visits?
I think it's really important as an author to go out and meet your readers, and I love hearing what they think about the books and getting feedback from them. And it's just amazing sort of to be amongst your readership and sort of hear their ideas. And I often get people saying to me, well, I'm writing a story, can you give me some feedback on it? And having little chats about that, it's just fantastic.
And what next for you then?
So I've actually got a third book in the pipeline that again is set in this area, so that's currently with Osborne, so fingers crossed that will be out next year.
And you're a children's writer now, is that how you define yourself, or will you put a toe into the world of adult fiction?
I think at the moment I'm really firmly in the children's writership, so I really love writing for children. I think that's where my heart lies at the moment.
What is it about writing for children that you like?
I think I was such an avid reader when I was young, visiting the library van when it came round every 3 weeks in the tiny village that I lived in. I always thought if I would write, it would be for children, because I got so much from books at that age. They taught me a lot about confidence and hope and family life, and I think if I can encourage children to read and also to write, I think that'd be a great accomplishment.
Is there one particular book that stayed with you?
I think one of my favourite reads was Little Women, and I reread that over and over again. In fact, I've recently seen the amazing film that's come out, and I read it again a couple of weeks ago after seeing the film. And I think that really taught me about family, writing about families in books, and characterisation, because the four girls are all so different in character. And so when I wrote my stories after reading Little Women, it made me think a lot about how to develop characters.
And it is a girl at the centre of your story. Important to have girls at the centre of stories for children.
I think it's important to have boys and girls. So I've got both in my book. So the female protagonist sort of is the main character in the book, but I certainly have boys as other characters. And The Garden of Lost Secrets, my first book, has sort of two main characters, really, Will and Clara. So I think it's really important to write for everybody inclusively. I don't write for boys or girls.
The House of 100 Clocks by A.M. Howell is published by Osborne Publishing. Our guest today on Bookmark is Christina Koning, here to talk about her novel End of Term. Christina, Anne-Marie there talking about plotting, red herrings and cliffhangers. You must be very aware of those kinds of things when you're writing a crime novel.
Well, I like reading classic crime. That's one of the reasons I got into writing this series, all of which is set in the late 1920s and the 1930s. And because I had sort of immersed myself in reading wonderful writers such as Dorothy L. Sayers, Agatha Christie, Nio Marsh and Marjorie Allingham, the great queens of crime, it seemed a natural progression to want to write some of it myself. I think because they were so good at plots, particularly Christie, whose plots are wonderful, you can sort of turn them around like a beautiful little machine and it all sort of clicks into place. I suppose it was really in sort of emulation of those that I tried myself. And I find it's very different writing this kind of genre fiction to writing the other sort. I never used to write plans and, you know, sort of structural models before. I simply used to knew I was going to write about something and simply let it go. But with this kind of work, you do have to know more or less how it's all going to work out. And I find it very satisfying. I sort of lie awake and think, oh, how am I going to get that bit to work? And how's this going? And then bang, it comes together. So yes, it's very satisfying.
Because you're not afraid in your novels of having quite a few characters there. There are quite a few suspects in there. We had students, we have dons, you know, various friends of those people. So yeah, there's quite a big range of people to choose from, all of whom feel very alive and real. But it's not the kind of locked room with only four people. There's quite a range of people and motives.
I do consider these stories to be an extension of my historical fiction, and I'm just as interested in the background and in getting the characters right, and both the language they use and I suppose the clothes they wear, the things they eat and drink and smoke, of course, because they all puff away like chimneys. It's getting those details right that is important to me, and I'm very pleased if you think that the characters seem real, because I'm not interested in the kind of crime fiction where, shall we say, the characters are rather disposable. I like the characters to seem as if you might just have met them. I think quite a lot about motive. You get slightly far-fetched motives and plots in some of the writers I've mentioned and quite a few of the others. I like to, as far as possible, make them seem plausible so that these really are things that can affect people, because I do take it seriously. As Hercule Poirot says, I do not approve of murder. And I think it is a terribly damaging and destructive thing for everyone involved, not just obviously the obvious people. And so it's important to kind of look at that and see how it resonates really throughout the plot.
Thank you, Christina. We've been talking to Christina today about her novel End of Term, which is published by Arbuthnot Press. Christina, what's next for you then?
I delivered a novel just before the lockdown began to my agent, and it was all set to go to the London Book Fair, and then, of course, the coronavirus happened. So now my novel, which is called The Hunger Winter, and is set in Holland during the occupation, but specifically in the winter of 1944-45. That novel is in publishing limbo at the moment. I'm waiting to hear eventually, when things do go back to normal, what will happen to it. Again, it is a historical novel. It's not a detective story, but it does involve aspects of the past and indeed my own past, because my father was Dutch. And my father's family were caught up in the events of the occupation and the Hunger Winter, which, for anyone who isn't familiar with that history, was a particularly devastating period in Holland's past. Not only, of course, did Holland lose more of its Jewish population than any other European country, 75%, but also they succumbed to a particularly bad winter. And because the country was cut off, people were starving, and 20,000 people or more died of starvation. It's a harrowing period. I was very interested in how people cope with crisis. Actually, I think there are parallels with our current situation. Many people are going through terrible suffering and have lost people they love. Obviously, when I wrote the novel, finished a few months ago, I didn't know any of this, but it does seem to me that you can look at similarities. And also, I'm interested in the way that people's humanity sort of comes through, even in terrible times. And the novel is a love story. So as Larkin has said, what will survive of us is love. I hope that that is true.
So are you going to come back to Frederick Rowlands?
Well, I have come back to him, actually. Because of having this time at home, I finished off a sixth novel. I move them on every 2 years, and they're all the odd years, except for short stories, which are in the even years. I know that sounds complicated, but that's just how it works for me. So the new novel is set in Spain and during the Spanish Civil War, and partly in England as well, and does involve Rowlands having to go to Barcelona. I like to move him around. He's been to Berlin, and he's, you know, he gets about a little bit, although he is London-based. Obviously, coming to Cambridge is a bit of a change for him too. So yes, that's the next one. And that's called Twist of Fate. That's also in publishing limbo, so we shall see, maybe, in due course. Oh,
yes, fingers crossed. I look forward to that. And a question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark: what are you reading at the moment?
I've chosen a novel that I am actually rereading by a Dutch writer called Harry Mulisch, and it's called The Assault. It was published in 1985, but it's actually about the occupation. And his character is a child, is a boy, who I think is probably based on himself. And again, it's about, in this case, a child coping with intolerable circumstances. You see him later as an adult, and the things that have happened to him as a child, which he didn't understand, have sort of resonated throughout his life. I think it's an absolutely wonderful novel. It was certainly an inspiration in writing The Hunger Winter, but I'm rereading it because I do like to reread things. I read them first quickly for research and then slowly for pleasure.
Thank you, Christine. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. But a heads up that our next show feature guest is Jan Casey, talking about her debut novel, The Women of Waterloo Bridge. We'll also hear from Jan Todd on her novel, Don't You Know There's a War On? And Imogen Alexander from Kettle's Yard will be talking about the new book that they've produced there for children about the artist Alfred Wallace. But we'll sign out now, Christina, with your last choice of music, which is the Rolling Stones' Miss You. Why this one?
I chose it for two reasons. One is that it connects loosely with my first novel, which, as I said, was set in 1977. Some Girls, the album from which this was taken, came out in 78. But the real reason is that I felt it was a perfect song for this period of lockdown, when so many of us are missing those we love. And so it's a message really to all of them, that I miss them, and I suppose we are all missing someone from our lives. And I think you say it very beautifully.
I've been holding out so long.